This is Fresh Air. Flyboy in the Buttermilk is a new collection of essays by Greg Tate about race, politics, literature, and music. Tate writes for the Village Voice. The introduction to his book was written by Henry Louis Gates, chair of Harvard's African American Studies Department. Gates describes Tate as a leading intellectual exponent of the hip-hop generation. Required reading. Greg Tate, along with guitarist Vernon Reed, co-founded the Black Rock Coalition, a group of African-American musicians who play rock and have had trouble breaking into the music industry because blacks are expected to play funk or rap, not rock. Tate often writes about music, rock, jazz, funk, and rap. His style of writing is sometimes straight ahead, but sometimes he writes in a style he describes as freaky deek.
Well, I think what I've tried to do is be true to my own impulses as a critic. And I mean, those I take my directives from the kind of music and the kind of art and the kind of literature that I like. And I've always tried to produce critical writing that had as much vitality and viscerality as the art or the phenomena or the experience that I was trying to describe to someone else. I'm really trying to plug a reader into my central nervous system in its most hot-wired state.
One of the forms of music you've written a lot about is rap, and there's a lot of the music that you really like a lot. On the other hand, you take issue with a lot of the points of view in the rock records. You once described Public Enemy as having a whack, retarded philosophy they espouse. What kinds of dilemmas does rap music present for you?
Well, I don't know that rap presents any more of a dilemma to me than any other form of music or any other form of argument. I think that one of the things that rap or hip-hop isn't given enough credit for is the spaces it opens for, you know, I think serious intellectual discussion around a lot of issues that are shrouded in silence in society, and particularly in African-American society, particularly issues around sexuality and gender, and also oppositional politics, and also the experience of working class black people and poor black people, people on the lower economic rung of the society. That's part of what hip hop does. I think hip hop is a venue for debate more than anything else, you know, and for argument and counter-argument.
Let me read an excerpt from your essay, The Devil Made Him Do It, Public Enemy. You write, to know Public Enemy is to love the agitprop and artful noise and to worry over the whack, retarded philosophy they espouse, like the black woman has always been kept up by the white male because the white male has always wanted the black woman, like gays aren't doing what's needed to build the black nation, like white people are actually monkeys' uncles because that's who they made it with in the Caucasian hills. Like, if the Palestinians took up arms, went into Israel, and killed all the Jews, it'd be all right. From this idiot blather, Public Enemy is obviously making it up as they go along. Since PE shows sound reasoning when they focus on racism as a tool of the U.S. power structure, they should be intelligent enough to realize that dehumanizing gays, women, and Jews isn't going to set black people free. You got a reaction from Public Enemy to this piece?
Well, I got a reaction from Chuck D at a concert they did the week after it came out, where it was kind of funny because I wasn't even in town. I was in Greece at an African reggae music festival that I've been invited to for a weekend. But I heard that, you know, I was referred to as a Village Voice porch nigger by Chuck in response to that, in that piece. But we since made peace. You know, he actually apologized to me for saying that.
I think he apologized to you while you were interviewing him for a piece in the Village Voice.
Right.
And in that piece, you were doing the interview along with Robert Christgau, who is the former music editor of The Voice.
Right.
And you were both really trying to, among other things, talk to Chuck D of Public Enemy about gay bashing. And
Yeah, homophobia.
Homophobia, yeah. And I don't think you were really getting through very far. What did you think? I mean, what was your approach to trying to talk with him about that?
To recognize the, you know, humanity of people who are gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think he acknowledged it without ever acknowledging that he would ever be comfortable with it. You know, I think he, you know, he was able to acknowledge it in theory, but I don't think in practice, you know.
You know,
that was the case.
So some people are just totally threatened by rap music altogether and can't deal with it. Some people just, you know, love the message, love the music. And some people, and I think you're probably in this category, really love a lot about it, but feel that they have to speak out about parts that they find really offensive, like the misogyny.
Well, certainly. I mean, and the thing, I think that because so many people are so terrified of who makes rap music and to a certain extent who consumes it and who they believe is influenced by it, that they lose sight of the fact that what makes it so powerful is courageous utterance. You know, I'm not saying wise, always profound, always insightful utterance, but it is about a personal truth. And I think that too often people are trying to deal with their fear of a black planet, as Public Enemy put it, through attacking the music or the messages in the music, you know, more than they're seeing that this is about one person who has an opinion and he put it to a beat and he gave it a good hook and he delivered it in a style that by the tenets of the music, it should be menacing and seductive.
My guest is Greg Tate, author of the new collection of essays, Flyboy in the Buttermilk. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Greg Tate, writes about culture and race for The Village Voice. One of your essays in your new collection, Flyboy in the Buttermilk, was about the rape of the Central Park jogger a couple of years ago. And let me quote a little bit of what you wrote in that. You wrote, "The extent to which this case of gang rape is an expression of sexism run amok in the black community remains ignored by the black press." How did you decide to pick up on that sexism in your coverage?
Well, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. I am trying to be a feminist man. I'll say it that way. And I'm very concerned with not just sexism in the black community, but silence around sexism in the black community. And I think that as a black man, it's irresponsible not to address that silence whenever and wherever it, you know, kind of rears its invisible head.
Let me quote something from another essay. You write that in your earlier days, you were very much the aesthetician. You write, "I believe that black cultural difference was going to set us free, that our salvation and liberation would come in realizing how great black art set us apart from the illen white boy and his creations." Tell me why you started believing that art and culture would be capable of so much, and when you stopped believing it.
Well, I think that when I was younger, my identity was empowered by the experiences I had, collective experiences I had with other black people in a musical context.
What were some of those key experiences that really excited you?
Oh, man. I mean, every concert I went to in Washington. I mean, a lot of it had to do with Washington itself being a predominantly black city where you could have, where essentially all of one's intellectual and artistic and spiritual experiences captained in a collective sense with pretty much the gamut of the black community. And there was an energy that one could draw on there that is not, I mean, it's not available in integrated, you know, or certainly predominantly white settings. You know, when you may be seeing the same artist, there's a call and response that goes on. There's a circular, there's a loop of energy that moves between the audience and the performers. And certainly seeing George Clinton in Parliament, Funkadelic, you know, really epitomized that for me, because I think that they broke the fourth wall down between the experience on stage and the experience in the audience more dramatically than anything I've seen outside of the Baptist church. It was, as George Clinton so elegantly put it, one nation under a groove.
So when did you stop believing that good music, good art could set you free, or set set all Black people free? You know what I mean? Just could be a total liberating experience.
Well, I think somehow over time I realized that people could not carry the experience that they had within the concert hall into the street, into their personal lives. You know, that release, that openness, that kind of sharing, mm-hmm. you know, that other kinds of experiences and other kind of discourse and other kind of dialogue was going to have to be necessary to make those kind of, that kind of consciousness and that kind of awareness available to people.
You mentioned in one of your essays that your mother was very active in civil rights groups and politically active as well. She was a press secretary for Jesse Jackson during one of his presidential campaigns, press secretary for Marion Barry during his first mayoral campaign. What kind of political values were stressed in the house when you were growing up?
Be Black. You know, it was, I mean, it was very interesting because my parents were doing were activists, and it wasn't even like these things were stressed, they were just lived. I mean, you were just aware of the fact that your parents were involved in a historic struggle against racial injustice in America, and we read all the things that my parents read. You know, there was a consciousness in the house around securing information and the understanding that knowledge is power, and that Black people needed knowledge to be empowered, to be able to participate in a fight against injustice.
So education was really important,
but not overemphasized. Mm-hmm. You know, I really am trying to stress the fact that it was that these things were, in a real casual kind of way, part of the environment. The intensity of political struggle in Black America in the 60s and 70s was a very casual part of the environment. You know, it was just something you accepted as normal. I thought, you know, this is the way everybody lived. I thought everybody was in my neighborhood was getting this kind of information from their parents, you know. That wasn't subsequently found that wasn't the case, but
if you don't mind my asking, I'm wondering what your mother's take has been about the kind of b-boy writing that you've done. You know, in the kinds of pieces where you use real b-boy kind of language, real hip hop language, and
you know, I have one of those mothers who's like the biggest fan of anything
right.
that their kids do. It's like. As long as it's said from the heart, as long as it's done with integrity and style, my mother's totally down with it.
Did you ever feel like you were rebelling against your parents or against being part of the Black middle class in any way by writing in that kind of style or by having dreads?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, because, like I said, my parents are what we call movement people. You know, they were always involved in the movement. So that meant they were always involved with younger Black people who were rebelling, you know, I mean, against their own parents or their upbringings. But my parents were totally open to the shape and form that the black struggle took when younger black people of another generation, you know, moved to the forefront of it. And, you know, my mother's one of Public Enemy's biggest fans, you know. I mean, there was a period where I know she was playing Nation of Millions every day. My father was getting sick of it, you know. It was like every morning, boom, bring the noise, you know. And like me, she knows all the lyrics, you know, backwards and forwards. You know, it's like I say, I mean, if it's done with style and integrity, if it's pro-black, my mother is with it.
Thank you very much for talking with
us. It's been a great interview. I really enjoyed myself.
Greg Tate's new collection of essays is called Flyboy in the Buttermilk. It's published by Simon & Schuster.